The incentive alignment is what I love about syndication investments, because Ryan's team is going to make money if they make this deal work really well. And so they're highly incentivized to make it work, because if they don't hit an 8% return to their investors, they're basically doing all this work free.
It costs us about $1.6 million to build those units. It improved the valuation of the facility by about $3 million. So we put in 1.6, we got a $3 million valuation, and the cash flow that came from those additional units, which again contributes to the value of the facility.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll.
Hey, welcome back to Passive Income Pilots, everyone. I'm your host, Tate Duryea, with my co-host here, Ryan Gibson. What's up, man? How's Seattle today?
Seattle is cold, and that's how it is. It's humid, it's cold in the winter, and when you see that 45 degrees, it's really like 20 degrees. So it's cold today. Yikes. But Tate, I just got back. I just got checked out in a Cirrus SR22T.
I got to see some photos of this. It looked awesome.
Oh, man. Super fun. I flew out to Atlanta, jumped in a Cirrus. Oh my God. I don't know if anybody's ever flown a Cirrus on here. Probably lots of listeners have. But man, that plane is a ton of fun. It's got a turbo, a twin turbo in it. It's got a weeping wing, which is a fancy way of saying it does anti-icing, not de-icing, but anti-icing. And it has oxygen. First time I ever used oxygen in a small aircraft. And then it pretty much is awesome. I mean, we were cruising around 200 to 250 knots across the ground, depending on the tailwinds that day. And we got to go see my portfolio on the East Coast. So we went up to Chattanooga, Louisville, Madison, Waukesha, Wisconsin, over to North Carolina, down to Florida, up to Georgia. And then I airlined back home. So super fun.
And this was because you just brought on a president of Free Up Storage, right? Which is your national storage brand.
Yeah. Yeah. So like, you know, I think as an aspiring pilot, I always had dreamed of like, you know, having my own plane and going and see my own projects. And like, we sort of got that dream to come true. And so we just brought on a new president of our storage company and a new chief legal officer. And then we had our VP of operations in the plane as well. So I was a little skinny on fuel most of the time to carry the weight, but that's one downside to the Cirrus, I guess, is it has a parachute in it. So it kind of messes right with the payload. But needless to say, for most of the trip, I just had three people. But and the legs that I had four, I was a little bit below tab. So, but great plane. And we were able to see like a ton of properties, meet a ton of people, figure out how to add a ton of value to our portfolio in the short time that we went around. So it was super fun.
Well, it sounds like the avionics on that thing are insane, because when I was a CSIP instructor, we didn't have any of this. You were saying you're four flight Bluetooth to the Garmin now. That's crazy.
Yeah. So I don't know if anybody, you know, I hadn't been flying small plane aviation up until a couple of years ago. I took like a 10, 15 year hiatus and I got back into it. And you go on your four flight app, you file your flight plan on your phone, takes like seconds. You get all the weather, you get a weather briefing. And then when you get to the plane, you literally Bluetooth it and it grabs a flight plan and it beams it into the airplane. So you don't have to load anything. You can do weight and balance and everything.
I mean, like, spinning knobs on the Garmin 430.
Oh yeah. Or just like spinning knobs on the VOR. Like, geez, I mean, none of that anymore. It's incredible. It's fun because it takes all the really hard work out of it. So you can really bomb around to a lot of different places. So a lot of fun. But you know, it's 2 years ago, Tate, today is the day 2 years ago that you and I rented an airplane. And we went to 9 self-storage properties from Tennessee, Georgia, and Florida in a similar manner, but in a slower plane, the Skyhawk 172SP.
It was nice,
and we knocked out our due diligence on a portfolio of over 4,000 units that we've owned now for a little over a year and a half. So, kind of exciting. We're going to get into that today.
We're going to get into that. We're going to get into value creation, why commercial real estate is so great, why we love it, why we chose to get into it. So I'm going to kick us off with a little story of how I got into real estate investing. This was in my late teens, early 20s. Read some books about flipping houses and buying rental properties and growing equity through that manner. Well, I bought my first single family home in Las Vegas in 2012. And this was when I was in my, gosh, mid-20s, early 20s. And I remember stepping out of the cab because Uber didn't exist then. And I had bought this property sight unseen. I got out of the car. I looked up. The front door was open. The movers were in the driveway. There's people mowing the lawns. And I just was terrified at what I had just done. I was, what have I done? This was the worst decision I ever made. I bought that house for $190,000. And it was a three bedroom, three bath in near Red Rock out there in West Las Vegas. Well, it turned out to be an excellent investment. And after that, I bought numerous other single family homes. And then I ran up against the same issue that a lot of real estate investors, aspiring real estate investors, run up against, which is realizing that, you know, for every additional home you buy, you have an additional water heater and garage door and roof and yard and all of these things that have to be managed. And so then you find multifamily, right? And multifamily is this big jump where you say, you know what, I want to put a bunch of units under one roof, and it is awesome. Big reason why it's awesome is because of the difference in how commercial real estate is valued versus residential. You know, I mean, yes, it's nice to have all of your stuff under one roof and have it all on one tax parcel, but the power of capitalization rate, or the idea of a commercial property being valued on a multiple of income rather than what your neighbor's house sold for, is where it's really powerful. So I want to give a quick example of how this works. So cap rate, we're not going to spend too long on this. We'll do a deep dive in another episode. A capitalization rate is essentially the same as PE ratio. Ryan, you want to break down what PE ratio is in the stock market?
I want to make cap rate so easy, it's impossible to forget.
Boom.
If you have a property that produces $100,000 of income on an annual basis, and you have a 10% capitalization rate, you have $1 million property.
That's it. So exactly.
This doesn't include the cash, the debt, or anything like that. Or it just, whatever cap rate, whatever income that produces. So if you buy let's say you go out and you find $1 million multifamily that Tate just bought, and it produces $100,000 of net profit every year, you just paid a 10% cap rate for that property. So it's the cash flow divided by the purchase price. That's it.
Exactly. That's it.
Exactly. It doesn't matter what debt's on it, right? Because like the debt is in the eye of the beholder. It's just taking the total profit and dividing into the purchase price. That's your cap rate.
And that's why debt is never included when you're looking at cap rate, because that's a variable. So it's just income minus the expenses. So whatever income you have left over, if you were to buy the property in cash, is your net operating income, or like Ryan said, net profit, right? NOI, or net operating income. So if the going cap rate in a market is 5% and you have $100,000 of net operating income, then you would have a $2 million property, right? Because 5% is 1/20th of the value. Same thing as PE ratio in a stock. If you're familiar with that, if it trades on a 20x multiple, it's the exact same thing as a 5% cap rate. So the cool thing about cap rate is that it works both ways. So if you have a property that, and I'd say 5% is a little bit more of a going market rate now for commercial real estate, wouldn't you say? So we'll use that.
Yeah, 5% is probably pretty accurate.
Probably
depending on the asset class.
Ballpark.
Exactly. Yeah, ballpark. Yeah. Let's use ballpark. That for our example today. Yeah.
Okay, great. So if I have a multifamily property, and it doesn't matter what asset class you're looking at, self-storage, multifamily, industrial, whatever, and I add $25 a month to one unit. So I raise the rent on one unit by $25. Well, that's an annual increase in net operating income of $300, right? Well, divided into a 5% cap rate, I've added $6,000 to the value of that property by adding $25 a month in rent to one unit. I've created $6,000 value. And that's not, you know, airy-fairy, you know, maybe. This is hard, tangible, appraised value based on the income approach. So if you do simple math and you say you have a 30 unit apartment complex, you've added $180,000 to that apartment complex just by raising rents by $25 or decreasing expenses by $25 a month per month per unit. So hopefully that makes sense. Brian, you want to clarify this?
Yeah, said differently, for every dollar that you increase profit, you've increased the value of the facility by $20. So
there it is.
If you're saving a dollar now, you've increased the value by $20. If you're earning an extra dollar, maybe you're charging more rent on an annual basis, your property's worth $20 more. So the multiple is extremely strong. So when you hear the word value add, like I'm a value add real estate investor, what you're doing is you're taking a property that has not reached its potential upside and you're doing something to it that increases the profit that is going to increase the value. So you're adding value to the property. And this could be things like, I bought this multifamily house and the appliances are old and run down and the countertops are old and I'm going to upgrade the appliances, do the countertops, put in new flooring, whatever it might be. And then I'm going to charge more rent. And even though I spent $5,000 a unit to do that upgrade, my increase of $100 in rent per month per unit is going to provide more valuation to the facility or to the apartment than what I'm spending in capital expenditure. So when you're thinking about, is it worth spending $5,000 on a property? You would say, well, how much more income is that property going to produce and at what cap rate valuation? And that's how you can make business decisions on what to do with your properties, which makes real estate so much fun.
It's so much fun. Not even to mention that then you can do a cost segregation study and depreciate all those things that you just put into it and you get all these tax benefits from it, but we're not even going to talk about that today. So we increase the income that tangibly increases the value. This is what's great about commercial versus residential is if you charge double the amount of rent that your neighbor is getting, that house isn't going to praise for any more because it's less than five units. And by the way, commercial real estate, a lot of people confuse multifamily with residential. Anything that is over four units on a single tax parcel is considered commercial real estate. It's multifamily commercial that is an asset class within commercial real estate. So if you have a quadplex, you can buy that with a residential loan, a triplex, a duplex. Those are all residential properties. Once you go to five and over, you're in the commercial world. So we want to talk today about how we added $8 million worth of value to a self-storage asset. And we'll talk a lot on this podcast about all the different asset classes in commercial real estate. But one of Ryan and my favorites is self-storage. And I think we'll save it for another episode. What do you think, Ryan, about all the reasons under the sun that we love self-storage? But let's walk through this story of how we created about $8 million worth of equity.
So we found a value add deal. This deal was in Corsicana, Texas. It's about an hour and 20 minutes south of the Dallas Metro Airport, DFW. And it's in a little town that is home to the fruitcakes. If you've ever had a fruitcake from the main, from the bakery, that is probably came from Corsicana, right? So also they have a mattress warehouse there, you know, kind of a growing town, small town, but we found a self-storage facility there. We found it through a real estate broker. And the story was the manager or the owner of the property was actually, it's kind of a sad story. He was going to pass away from cancer. And so he was under the gun to sell and his children didn't want the asset. So he wanted to sell it. So the year was 2018. And we bought the facility for $6 million. And our plan to add value was to raise the rents on the existing customers because when we looked at the whole market, we noticed that the market was 98% occupied. So everybody else was basically full. And they were charging significantly more, about 30% more than what this facility was charging. And the quality of their facilities were worse or same. So we looked at the what's called the rent roll and we said, hey, we can raise these customers' rents from you know, $20 or $30 a month for a smaller unit to maybe $50 or $60 a month. And when you do that over 800 units, that's significant value when you consider right. the NOI and the cap rate, right? The net profit we talked about earlier, dividing it by that five cap. Well, we were conservative and we just gave this a 6.8% cap rate on our value. So,
and just to be clear, a higher cap rate means lower value. So cap rates move in inverse with value. So if cap rates rise, it means that that stream of income is worth less. And if cap rates drop, it means that value goes up for the same amount of cash flow stream. Just want to clarify that.
Yeah, absolutely. And what was cool about this property was I actually had a car wash on the front. We didn't really want the car wash, but it had a car wash on the front. And what we did was we bought the property. What was really cool is the day we got the property, we got an appraisal for $6.75 million. So the day we bought it, we had arguably $750,000 of equity just instantly. So we got a great deal on it. We sold that car wash for $1 million and paid down the investors. So about 50%, just a little shy of 50%. I think 40% of the capital went back to the investors. And as an aside, Tate invested, I think he invested $50,000 or something like that in the deal.
Something like that. This was my first passive deal because I owned some multifamily and was not loving the asset management. You know, I had a property manager, but it's six time zones away. And it's just I'm chasing contractors and lenders and insurance companies around. It's just, so I met Ryan at a conference. You may have heard this in a few episodes back, but you guys had this deal. This was the first time I'd heard of passive investing. And so I threw in some money as a limited partner in this deal, meaning that I was basically the money and Ryan and his team were doing all the work. And I get a better split of the profit for them doing all the work. It's a pretty sweet deal. So anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. So and Tate got an 8% preferred return, meaning that any profit that came from the facility first had to go until Tate achieved an 8% preferred return, meaning that if he put in $100,000, he would have to be paid $8,000 a year, $666 a month, whatever that boils down to per day, but he was accumulating that 8% pref that had to be paid to him first.
Right. And before the split kicked in between me and the other investors and Ryan and his team.
That's right. And so, you know, we bought this property, we raised the rents, and we also built additional units. We actually put our construction team out there. We added on 40,000 square feet of additional storage because there was so much demand, 240 units, and we filled up those units. So those additional units, it cost us about $1.6 million to build those units. It improved the valuation of the facility by about $3 million. So we put in 1.6, we got a $3 million valuation and the cash flow that came from those additional units, which again, contributes to the value of the facility. So now you've got this 1,000 unit facility, all these tenants. How else can you add value? Well, we raise the rents to market. But what we do as an operator is we sell these tenants insurance. So we will require all the tenants to have rental insurance, and we actually get a split of that profit with our preferred lender. So we get 70% of the profit that comes off the insurance. So all these customers had to pay $13 to $18 of insurance, and we're taking 70% of that revenue and sharing it with Tate. So that's another way we added value, and almost at no cost. So think about 1,000 people paying roughly $13 a month. You can do the math here.
I'll do the math for you.
$13,000.
$13,000. That's a month 12. Times 12. Yep. And you divide that by, I don't know, let's just say a 5% cap rate. Well, you've just added $3.12 million worth of value.
Yep.
That's the magic of commercial
real estate. So we expanded the property. Yeah, $3 million. We added insurance, $3 million. We raised the rents, probably another $3 million, $2 million, call it. Plus some expenses in construction, et cetera. So that's how we added $8 million of value. So now the facility is being sold for roughly $14 million. We bought it for $6 million. And remember, we already returned back $1 million from the car wash. So when the car wash sold, we returned
back. And I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I was going to say that sounded high. I did the math wrong. $260,000. My mistake. So yeah. $13,000. No. Yeah. It was $13,000 a year.
No, you had the math right.
Yeah, I had the math right. Okay. Yeah. All right. Just wanted to make sure, fact check myself.
Now, Now, the reality is that not everybody takes our insurance plan. So maybe you can take about 70% right. of that number. Again, we're not trying to do a bunch of brain damage on this podcast. We're just trying to
right.
paint the picture of how do you add value in storage? How do we right. add value to this specific property? And how do you get a bigger valuation? So when another group comes in to buy this property, they're going to say, wow, you're getting all this income from insurance. You're getting all this income from rent. You're getting all this income from this additional units. The market is a 5% cap rate. We're willing to pay you the income that comes in on an annual basis divided by the cap rate. And that's how this value is created. It's not, right. you know, oh, I like the latches on your doors and the concrete in your unit and the color paint and the countertops in the office. It has nothing to do with anything. You know, it's all about the income that we're producing on this asset and what the market cap rate is. And so that's how we created a ton of value. And by the way, you know, we've been cash flowing. So every month Tate gets a check in the mail from this facility of about how much, yeah. how much did we, so been like,
I think it's about nine or 9% for the last year, 9 or 10%. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's so, after and that, we've even sent back about half your money. So it's been pretty good.
Yep. Yeah. From the car wash sale. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so pretty good. So yeah, I got half my money back during the car wash sale and then, or thereabouts. And then there's another, what, 9-10%, 8-10%, something like that, based on the 25. Yep. I'm sorry, based on the 50 that I invested, not based on, you know, my reduced capital account. So it's pretty sweet. You know, when you get a return of capital from a refinance or a sale of some of the property, your basis is not diluted. But in any case.
And here's the best part. Have you ever been to this property, Tate?
I haven't. I've seen a bunch of drone footage.
Have you ever done any work on this
That's
property?
The best part.
Yeah.
Haven't lifted
yeah.
a finger.
You haven't been there. Are you familiar with how many water heaters are at it? I am, actually. I think there's one.
I have no clue.
No clue. And
that's the beauty
I've been
of
there
it.
A couple times, but we have a big team that manages the property. We have a store manager that's there. We got an ops team. So again, this is I do all the work. Tate makes all the money. And when Tate makes his money, then I get to start splitting money after that. And that's a syndication in a nutshell. It's right. It's like you find an operator, somebody who's successful in real estate and you can trust, really, really important. You know, you kind of look at, yep. do I like the market? Do I like the asset class? Do I like the operator? That's your funnel, right? Market, yep. asset class, and operator. Those are your three criteria. Tate, you know, got to know who I was. He put his trust into me and my company. My company found a good asset in a good market.
Yep.
And we were good operators. We performed really well. And so Tate got to benefit from those profits. And then now that we've paid him, now any money that comes in, we get to split. So since we've achieved the preferred return hurdle, I'm actually benefiting from cash flow and that investment as well, because anything after an 8% pref, that gets split with Tate and myself. And that's pretty typical in a syndication. And that car wash sale, how that gets handled is really important. When you're thinking about a syndication, you want to ask the operator, hey, what happens if you refinance this property? What happens if you sell a portion of this property? How does that money get handled? And, you know, we talked about the preferred return that comes from cash flow from operations. So like those are customers paying us every month or insurance money coming in. But when you sell a portion of the property, that's called a liquidity event. Or when you refinance a property, that's called a liquidity event. And in that case, Tate got his preferred return if there was any accrual left paid down, which I don't think there was,
but it's important to note that usually a syndication deal does not hit the pref in the first few years. So just because it says an 8% preferred return, the first year might be zero. It might be 4, 5, 6, whatever, but you don't lose the deficit. That rolls over to future years and it's still owed back to you.
Yeah. Sometimes it's in investor dashboards, you have a preferred return accrual balance. So you can see how much has accumulated and how much you're owed before there's any splits with the sponsor, which is really right. important. And a sponsor is just another fancy word of saying the operator or the person who's in charge of the deal.
Right.
So when that liquidity event happened, Tate got his principal back, some of his principal, about 40% of it. And then his money that's in there now, he still makes income on that. It's still split. But we get some of it because we've kind of done our job to a certain extent. Right. We haven't completely done our job because we haven't sold the property yet. But now we're kind of, you know, it's incentive aligned to benefit the investors first, and then we start getting a little bit of money once a certain threshold has been hit. And so we're sort of paid on the backside. So there's a good alignment for investors to come into a syndication typically, right? You got to make sure you do your due diligence on that. Now when the property sells.
Yeah, it's incentive alignment. That is what I love. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry, say that again. I kind of jumped a little bit. I think the recording.
Oh, just just the incentive alignment is what I love about syndication investments is because, you know, Ryan's team is going to make money if they make this deal work really well. And so they're highly incentivized to make it work, because if they don't hit an 8% return to their investors, they're basically doing all this work free, sans, you know, a couple points of acquisition and management fees, which really just keep lights on.
Exactly. And, you know, my first operators that I invested with as a passive investor, I made the mistake, my scars, looking backwards, the worst deals that I've ever invested in, the sponsor wasn't getting paid very much. So my first in syndication actually had no fees to the sponsor. And it was a property.
It seems generous, right? It seems.
Yeah, we're like, oh, well, you know, I don't need to charge fees. I've got enough money, blah, blah, blah. BS. Because here's why, right? Every time, so like that project was supposed to be built and operating within a year. It took 5 years for that sponsor to build it. And every time I went by the project, he was out there working on the project, like physically doing the work. And it's like, dude, you need to hire a team and you need to charge fees.
You get what you pay for.
Hire the right people to do the job, right? So, you know, people are like, a hot button for me is like fees. You know, when I want to see the sponsor charging fees, I want to see the sponsor. I want to know how much they're making, because I want them to make money. Because if they make money, then they're motivated to do my project. If they're not making any money, what motivation are they going to have? So I like seeing fees. Fees can be excessive, but a right amount of fees is perfect for alignment to make sure everybody's making money and can keep the lights on. So, now, just to recap this, so we bought it for $6 million. We sold the car wash for $1 million. So now our basis is $5 million, and we're selling the property for about $14 million. And that's where the value comes in. So when the property sells, Tate is going to get the remaining money that he has in the deal back, plus a profit. And so I think it's going to work out probably a 30-40% annual return when you consider the cash flow along the way, plus the upside from the sale. I don't know what the exact numbers are, but it's going to be pretty high. And that's how a syndication works.
That's it.
In a nutshell.
Yeah. Yeah. You go in, you know, you buy something, you add value to it, and you sell it. I mean, that's usually the space that we play in.
Absolutely. And, you know, I did the same thing. I you know, I wanted to buy a house in every layover I was in. I think that ended after one layover, buying a house. you know, because I thought it'd be fancy, like, oh, I'll be in my layover and I'll stop by the house and, you know, I'll find a project manager and a property manager, blah, 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 blah. And it was like just a disaster trying to find the right people all on my own without a team. So that's why I love commercial real estate as well. And I love syndications. And this is pretty much where all my money is now. I've invested passively in about 8 or 9 syndications outside of my own company syndications. Additionally, more so, I invest in most of our deals. So,
and to give a quick context of how we participate here at Turbine, Turbine is not an operator. We do not go out. We don't have a 110. How many employees do you have now?
123.
We do not have 123 employees. We're super lean. It's myself and a handful of others. We've got some really smart people on our board of advisors. We're a little bit more nimble, whereas Ryan's company focuses just on self-storage. They're experts in that. We have done funds for your deals in the past. We intend on doing them in the future. The way that we get paid is we aggregate a bunch of our investors together. We invest with Ryan, and Ryan says, hey, we'll give you a better split because you're writing a really big check. And my company can take that delta, so our investors get the same or sometimes even better economics by investing with us. And you guys are willing to do that because the less time you spend raising money from private investors means that you can go out and do what you do best, which is finding, acquiring, and executing your business plans on excellent real estate, right?
That's right. So, yeah. And we have a, you know, what Tate does is not an uncommon thing. It's not a, you know, it's not a secret, you know, unique thing that he does. There's tons of funds out there. But what I love about Tate's fund is, you know, he's a little bit more niche, right? So like there's some big funds out there, big real estate groups, big publicly traded stuff that you can go into, but they're not niche-y. They're just buying the, it's kind of like buying the index or buying the average, right? Tate is finding some of the like most niche, edge case sort of awesome opportunities, like a mobile home park that has a unique repositioning to it, or an apartment deal that has something similar, like in a really good market. He's doing things that are not publicly available. They're private investments that he has like a really close ear to the ground, and he can really find these like niche-y opportunities, which produce great outsized returns. And so I love what you do, and I love, you know, we're collaborators, we're not competitors, right? So he's raising money for different asset class types. I'm kind of jealous, right? Because like I'm, you know, I'm the operator. I'm doing all the work. I'm doing all the heavy lifting, and I'm kind of stuck in one asset class, where Tate is like, you know, I'm just looking for the best opportunities, and then, you know, and doing the fun stuff, raising the money. So
that's what I actually, you know, I allude to this all the time, that, you know, we're in an enviable position as a fund because we're super nimble. I mean, you have how many people just on your acquisitions team?
Like five.
Seven?
Yeah.
So, okay, it's five now. Yeah. I mean, five people that just take brokers to lunch and cold call owners to try and turn over rocks and get deals, right? So if Ryan wanted it just one day, for example, I don't think this would ever happen, but said, hey, self-storage sucks now, we want to pivot. It'd take you a decade to build a team around a different asset class, right? And to build the relationships and, you know, and you're nationwide, but a lot of syndicators are specific to a single geography.
Right.
So if they say, okay, Austin is overheated, we need to go somewhere else, it takes a long time for them to spool up in a different geography. Whereas we work with top tier operators in multiple different asset classes. And we kind of do the same funnel where it's like, you know, asset class, market, operator, deal. And we have a very, very smart board of advisors that looks at these deals with us. Our CFO is, Grant Cardone, CFO. He looks over the underwriting, which is the numbers analysis, and does all of our quantitative due diligence. So you're getting a very scrutinizing third party opinion before it goes on our platform. So of course, these operators are doing their due diligence on these deals before they offer them in the first place, because their goal is to make money, and they have to pay usually a preferred return to their investors first. So they're doing DD, but then we're doing sort of third party DD on top of that, and then just getting better economics for large check size. So
yeah.
Anyway, that's how it works.
Yeah. So, you know, if you want to sign up for Tate's list, you can go to where?
Turbinecap.com.
Turbinecap.com. If you want to invest in one of our deals, you can go to our list, Spartan-investors.com.
Yep.
Get on.
Highly encourage you to get on Ryan's list, get on our list, and look at the deals that come across the table.
You know, another thing too is like, you know, I've had friends that have sat on my list for like 5, 6, 7 years. There's never any pressure. You don't have to invest, you know, and then all of a sudden, you know, 5 years goes by and they say, hey, you know, all my student loans are paid off and I got a house and I'm in a better spot and I just got a promotion at work or whatever. And they say, hey, I'm in. You know, and I encourage people to do that. Jump on a bunch of people's lists. I mean, we had Jeremy Roll on a podcast. And, you know, I love what he said. He's like, go on CrowdStreet, YieldStreet, whatever, and like download all their things and look at what's happening in the market and what other people are doing. And that way you can kind of be like, you know, it's kind of like learning how to read a METAR or a TAF. It's like, now you can just glance at it and know exactly what's going on in like 10 seconds, right? So that's like reading what's called an offering memorandum is, you know, in these commercial real estate deals, you can become more familiar with what they look like, increase your deal flow, become more familiar with what's out there. And, you know, and the first step in that is just to get on one of our lists. And here's the other thing. You may want to get into this on your own. You might say, hey, I'm thinking about becoming a full-time real estate investor. And you learn a ton from the content that Tate puts out and the content that Spartan puts out.
Yep.
We have a meetup group. We have webinars. You know, it's another piece to the puzzle in your journey to learn about investing. And so even if you're not going to invest, it's a great place to hang and see what's going on and learn about different things. So I would say investing or not, you know, it's always good to get on a distribution list and just kind of see what other people are doing. So
I love it. Love it. Yeah. Well, that's how we create value in commercial real estate. I hope that that sort of explains why you might see, I know that some people, when they see a projected return of 18%, they go, ah, that seems too good to be true. It's just math. And it's usually fairly conservative.
Yeah. And here's the thing. Here's the reality too, because I hang out in a lot of institutional forums. Mm-hmm. 18% is really good. And there's more and more investors moving to that. And I just want to touch on this really quickly before we sign off. Yeah. I mean, the traditional portfolio is 60-40, right? 60% stocks, 40% bonds. Mm-hmm. And I just listened to some very big institutional shops say, that's broken, right? That's done, right? Because people are going into these private placements or these syndications that me and Tate are talking about that we did together. They're starting to allocate more and more funds to these syndications. Right. And 20-30% over the last 5 years, annualized returns are not uncommon, right? Because real estate did really well, and you know, real estate tends to continue to do really well. But what you're trading is liquidity, right? You can put your money in the market and you can pull that money out, but you're trading kind of that liquidity option. That's why you get a premium on this money. So I do want to clarify that a little bit. I mean, these deals do really well and they're really niche, and it's a way to get an outsized return based on your risk, but you're also in illiquid investments, meaning you can't call up Tate and say, you know, I gave you that 50 grand last year, but I need it back. It's not there, right? So these are illiquid investments. You can't trade them on the market. You can't sell your position to somebody else. They're illiquid. So you should expect a premium on these types of investments because they're illiquid investments until the asset sells. Yeah.
And the other thing to touch on too is like, well, you know, I mean, if they're so great, why isn't everybody doing them? Well, if you're Goldman Sachs and you've got, you know, $50 billion to deploy, it's not very simple. You know, we talked about this story of us buying a $6 million self-storage facility. Well, if you have $50 billion that you're trying to deploy into real estate, you know, it's just not going to happen. I mean, you can't go down to this small of a level and extract value on a property by property basis if you just have that much capital to deploy. And that's why there's trillions and trillions of dollars globally in low and sometimes even negative interest rate bonds.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting too. You can go to formsd.com, and there's over 19,000 syndications that happen every single year. There's over $3 trillion raised in this space. What's interesting too is there's actually more syndications. There's more unregistered syndications. That's what we're talking about. That's what Tate and I did, at unlicensed, unregistered syndications, neither approved or disapproved by the SEC, than there are registered securities.
What we mean by registered securities is essentially IPO'd. It's a publicly traded security. So there are more private placements now in the US than there are, you know, opportunities that are public, that are technically registered under the Securities Exchange Commission.
And these used to be country club deals, right? This is used to be like, I know a guy who buys real estate and, you know, his stuff fills up really fast. So if you got to be on a short list and you got to invest a lot of money. And what's great is in 2012, the Jobs Act came out and it allowed us to advertise these deals. And that's why I think you start seeing more of them, because now you can actually go public and advertise these deals so long as your investors are accredited. Yeah.
Correct. So this is this brought in the 506C SEC exemption, which this was the Obama Jobs Act that allowed for crowdfunding. And I think the term is general solicitation. It means that you can tell somebody that you don't already have a pre-existing relationship with about the deal, which prior to 2012, that was illegal. You had to know someone to tell them about your deal.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So a lot of information here. Just wanted to kind of paint the landscape of, you know, how Tate's fund works, how our fund works, how we add value to commercial. Just kind of another flavor to this conversation with single family versus multifamily versus self-storage, whatever it might be. But if you want to learn more about this, I actually have an ebook on this, and I'll link this out in the show notes. But I do a deep dive on Syndication 101. I talk about the deal that we just talked about a little bit more in depth. I also have a book on how to evaluate a sponsor. So the book talks about, okay, so where do you find sponsors? And then how do you evaluate them? What's your due diligence checklist look like? Tate does a lot of that work for you in his fund, but you should read the book to understand the value that Tate's providing you when he's going out and looking for these operators and doing his due diligence. So we'll put the links in the show notes. to the two books, the two ebooks that we have free to our listeners. And yeah, if you have any more questions about that, send us an email. Where should people email us, by the way? Do we have an email yet?
PassiveIncomePilots@gmail.com goes to both of us, but honestly, it's easier if it's just Tate@turbinecap.com, TAIT@turbinecap.com, or Ryan@spartan-investors.com.
Yeah, shoot us an email, ask us a question about it. So thanks everybody for listening. We hope you found not only value in this, but applicability, and we'll catch you on the next episode.
See you next time.